From NPR West, you're listening to the podcast edition of All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. I'm Arun Roth. This episode, the nationwide debate over the police use of deadly force is taking place in the dark. At this moment, there are no solid numbers on how often police kill civilians.
There's really just no way to know what we don't know.
Activists worry about what a single disputed story could mean for the fight against sexual assault on campus.
The way that we react to this story is going to be as important as the story itself.
Also today, former poet laureate Donald Hall, now 86, shares the secret of his success.
I love to work. Work in my life has meant only one thing, and that's a pen on the paper.
And why finding an affordable apartment in Beijing could mean living underground.
It's the official building code to build bomb shelters. That's a lot of new underground space that's increasing in supply all the time.
Plus, making the movie that made Prince a star. That's all on this episode of All Things Considered from NPR West. It was a brutal story, a rallying point for activists fighting sexual assault on college campuses. Rolling Stone told the story of a woman called Jackie, who says she was savagely beaten and gang-raped at a frat party at the University of Virginia. But the reporter never contacted the alleged attackers, and now Rolling Stone has apologized for the story, saying its trust in Jackie was misplaced. For her part, Jackie has told the Washington Post that she stands by her version of events. For reaction on this, we're joined by Mary Beth Seitz Brown. She's with the group Students Active for Ending Rape, or SAFER. Mary Beth, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So when this story first appeared in Rolling Stone, what was your reaction?
My reaction was that, you know, this is yet another example of how college campuses continue to systematically sweep sexual violence under the rug until it becomes a major PR issue for them. And I think this story in particular is very sensationalized, but there are thousands of other stories that show the same patterns, which is that there is both institutional and community betrayal of survivors, which causes them to be further traumatized and prevents them from getting the support and resources that they need for healing and justice.
And obviously the story got a ton of attention worldwide. How did you react when you heard that Rolling Stone was backing off from Jackie's story?
I was very disappointed. Rolling Stone clearly did not perform their own due diligence while reporting this story. And rather than apologizing for their own editorial mistakes, they blamed a rape survivor who is still recovering from excruciating trauma and saying that they should not have trusted her. Discrepancies in this story does not necessarily mean that the allegation is false or that the survivor is not trustworthy. It is incredibly common for survivors of any kind of trauma, not just sexual trauma, to remember some details extremely vividly, while maybe some other memories may be blurry. And ultimately, if you're not able to adhere to journalistic standards while you're reporting a story without re-traumatizing or re-victimizing a survivor, then you probably shouldn't publish that story, especially if their survivor is uncomfortable with it being printed for fear of retaliation.
You know, there's a lot of reporting in the Rolling Stone piece that had nothing to do with Jackie's account about other victims who have come forward and resistance on campus to reporting and accountability. Do you worry that all gets lost now in the controversy over Jackie's story?
I hope it doesn't, and I think the way that we react to this story is going to be as important as the story itself. For me, I think the real learning that's come out of this statement and this new development is that journalists need to be trained in how to conduct trauma-informed investigations. Many survivors are completely ignored by their colleges until they take their stories to the press. So the press really does play a real role. And if Rolling Stone and others want to report about these issues, then they need to understand that PTSD, anxiety, depression, these can all affect survivors and they can affect memory surrounding the incident. So that makes it very difficult to present a perfectly consistent, airtight narrative to a journalist.
Do you think that what's happened with this Rolling Stone story has been a setback for people and groups trying to bring attention to campus sexual assault?
I don't necessarily think it has to be a setback. I think this can be a moment of education and to help people understand what does it actually feel like to have experienced sexual violence and what does it mean in the aftermath about your ability to recall those memories, your ability to share that experience with usually a complete stranger or an audience of complete strangers. So I think if we seize this moment and say, let's learn about the effects of sexual trauma on those who have experienced it, then I think that can be a place to actually, you know, really build some nuance into this movement and help people empathize with survivors, which at the end of the day is what we're asking for.
Mary Beth Seitz Brown is with the group SAFER, that's Students Active for Ending Rape. Mary Beth, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Ferguson, Cleveland, New York City. After several incidents of police killings around the country, many Americans are scrutinizing how police use deadly force. But this debate over the use of force is happening without solid data on how often these killings happen. The FBI does keep a tally of justifiable homicides by police departments around the country. But when the Wall Street Journal asked local agencies for their stats, they found that many police killings simply go uncounted by the FBI. Here's reporter Rob Berry.
We chose the top 110 largest departments by full-time sworn officers and asked them to provide us with the number of people who had been killed by their officers each year for about a six-year period.
And so when you compared those numbers from those departments with the FBI's numbers, what did you find?
We wound up finding about 550 incidents that had occurred in this time span but had never been reported or at least weren't currently reflected in the FBI's figures. And there were a number of reasons for that. Some of it was because agencies didn't report them. And that's very normal. This isn't a required thing. Roughly a third of the agencies we looked at really weren't participating in it for one reason or another. This stuff is included in these FBI crime reports. And the information that we're looking at actually is about all homicides. But some of those homicides are coded in this information as justifiable homicides by law enforcement. And we found some agencies like in Fairfax County, Virginia, for instance, where they seem to have been reporting all of these homicides, but they never seem to have any justifiable homicides by law enforcement. They said that it was because the crime reporting didn't cover justifiable homicides by law enforcement, which aren't crimes. So they had this interpretation that it just wasn't right to include cases involving, you know, legal interventions, deaths that are not illegal, to put those in a report called a crime report. So there was that, and then a bunch of other much larger issues. For instance, some of the largest states in the country, New York, Florida, most of Illinois, their information does not wind up in the FBI's records, and that's for a variety of reasons. It's not really the agency's problems. It's the states that are responsible for getting that stuff, because the way these records work is they're reported from every agency up to a state-level agency for the most part, and the state passes them on to the FBI. And what we found is in Florida and New York and Illinois, that wasn't happening.
Do you have a sense, though, of even after your reporting, how much we still don't know about these kind of killings?
No, and that's something that, you know, I think we tried to talk about in the story, is that there's really just no way to know what we don't know. Just for perspective, over the entire period of time we looked at, something on the order of 750 police departments had reported something to the FBI about these incidents. But there's about 18,000 police departments across the country. We talked to 110 of them, and we found a bunch of stuff was missing. When you get to the smaller agencies, there's just no way to know.
Rob, imagine for a moment that you're not a reporter but an editor. What advice would you give to your reporters when it comes to using FBI statistics?
Well, use discretion, I think. We really need to talk to experts about this, people who work with this stuff for a living. You know, there are folks in government who study this stuff, publish reports on it, and they'll be the first to tell reporters, hey, you know, be really careful what you say about this because it's just not right. But I think what it comes down to is a question of why. You know, why isn't it right? What can we do to make it better? Where is the breakdown happening?
That's Rob Berry. He's a reporter with the Wall Street Journal and he joined us from New York. Rob, thank you.
Thank you.
Anger and frustration over two recent cases where unarmed black men were killed by police brought new protests to New York City, Chicago, Washington, Boston, Miami, and Cleveland this week. From our Code Switch team, NPR's Shireen Marisol Meraji takes us to a Wednesday night potluck in Ferguson, where black and white community members are trying a different tactic to create change.
The potluck spread in the Fellowship Hall of the North Hills United Methodist Church in Ferguson this week is chicken, cream of potato soup, meatballs, and four desserts. About 20 people showed up to eat and talk. The group's half black, half white. It skews older, but a 12-year-old and two teenagers sit around the huge table, too. There's laughter and some small talk, but between bites, a whole lot of real talk.
My broader community, I don't think, gets it. We hear about the police profiling. And I'll tell you, be honest, in my own mind, it's like I think, well, how much of that is behavior related?
Bob Levin grew up in St. Louis. He's a local pastor in his early 60s.
So I'm wrestling with this, you know, but I'm willing to listen.
I get that. So I'm not offended. I don't mind speaking on it so that you can have a better understanding.
37-year-old single dad and college student Reginald Strode tells Levin from across the table about getting pulled over time and time again in St. Louis.
The majority of the time, it was just like nothing going on. I'm scratching my head like, why'd you pull me over?
We don't know each other. We don't know each other's hopes and dreams and fears. Our kids don't play together. We don't eat together. And so we don't know the struggles and the successes and what life is for our neighbors.
That's Pastor Daryl Meese. These Wednesday night potlucks were his idea. Meese says he realized how divided Ferguson really was this past August after the unrest following the death of Michael Brown. So in October, he launched a group he calls Ferguson Forward and invited members of his church, people he sees at local coffee shops, anyone willing to talk it out respectfully.
Even at the very first meeting, I remember as we were picking up, I looked over and two people that didn't know each other before at all, who are different ethnically and socioeconomically, are standing in what would normally be considered very personal space having conversation. And I thought, that is working. Something's working.
And to keep it working, Mee says these dinners need to become a regular part of community life. The group took a Wednesday off during the World Series and one before Thanksgiving. But Mee wants to keep breaks like that to a minimum because regularity fosters comfort and comfort leads to honest conversation.
I don't see love. I don't see peace. I don't see any caregiving. All I see is taking, and I see complete and total destruction. Right.
Don Wilson is Mies's partner at Ferguson Forward. He spoke this week about frustrations over the looting and destruction that followed the grand jury announcement. But 16-year-old Taylor Strode defended the young people she's protested with, saying they were peaceful. She told Wilson and Pastor Meese and everybody else at the table that her dad and her brother can be killed by a cop with no consequence, and she won't be silent.
Our voices matter. We are the voice of change. If we start somewhere, then maybe we can do something.
That's wonderful to hear from my perspective, and I don't think that came across clearly in the media. And believe me, nothing much has come across clear.
For Pastor Meese, these potlucks are a way to get some clarity. But the ultimate goal, he says, is to progress from sharing stories and airing grievances to finding solutions to the problems of racism and distrust.
And we set forth to do that very work. So, Father,
this week's Ferguson Forward gathering, like all the ones before, ends with a prayer. And Don Wilson takes the lead.
Till we meet again, may they be safe, may they be loving, and may they be prepared to even give more the next time that we meet.
Shireen Marisol Meraji, NPR News.
Amen.
Amen.
More than 21 million people live in Beijing, so even the tiniest apartments can cost a fortune. But there is an underground market. Literally, people are living underground. Below the city's bustling streets, bomb shelters and storage basements are turned into apartments. An estimated 1 million of Beijing's residents live underground. Annette Kim, an urbanization researcher at the University of Southern California, spent last year in China's capital city studying Beijing's underground housing market.
Part of why there's so much underground space is because it's the official building code to continue to build bomb shelters and basements. That's a lot of new underground space that's increasing in supply all the time. They're everywhere.
Kim says apartments go as deep as three stories below ground. Residents have communal bathrooms and shared kitchens, and the tiny windowless rooms have just enough space to fit a bed.
It's tight, but I also lived in Beijing for a year, and the city in general is tight.
Living underground at about $70 a month offers an affordable alternative. But there's a stigma to living in basements and bomb shelters. During her research, Kim interviewed residents above ground about their neighbors directly below.
They weren't sure who was down there. There is actually very little contact between above ground and below ground, and so there's this fear of security.
She says the underground dwellers are mostly young migrants who moved from the countryside looking for work in the big city.
They're all the service people in the city. They're your waitresses, store clerks, interior designers, tech workers. You just can't afford a place in the city.
Kim says there's a range of units, from the dark and dingy to the neatly decorated. But it's rare to get a glimpse below. Property owners are strict about who they let in. That didn't stop Beijing-based photographer Chi Yin Sim.
I started to try and find ways to get down there because I was fascinated by the fact that there was a universe beneath our feet.
The first basement dweller she met was a young woman, a pedicurist at a salon, who lived with her boyfriend.
I was just like, can I come and visit? And she was like, sure, come and visit us.
In the photo, the couple sits on their bed, surrounded by clothes, boxes, and a giant teddy bear, all two floors below a posh Beijing apartment complex. Sim's pictures reveal rooms that look like prison cells, personalized to varying degrees.
The air is not so good, ventilation is not so good. And the main complaint that people have is not that they can't see the sun, it's that it's very humid in the summer. So everything that they put out in their rooms gets a bit moldy because it's just very damp and dank underground.
Sim says many people simply adapt to the closed quarters.
At dinner time, you can hear people cooking. You can hear people chit-chatting in the next room. You can hear people watching television. It's really not so bad. I mean, you're spending almost all your day at work anyway, and you're coming back, and all you need is a clean and safe place to sleep in.
She also met a number of people who were too embarrassed to have their photo taken, especially since one Chinese newspaper referred to Beijing's underground residents as the rat tribe. It's especially difficult for the older residents, the ones who have been down there for years, says Annette Kim.
They're hoping that their next generation, their children, will be able to live above ground. It's this sense of longing and deferring a dream, and so it makes me wonder how long this dream can be deferred.
Kim says housing laws changed in 2010, and living underground is now illegal. But she says it's still an active market. For hundreds of thousands of people, it's the only viable option for living in, or under, Beijing. To see more of Chi Yin Sim's amazing photos, check out our website, npr.org. Our country has never had a poet laureate, probably, who is so ambivalent about the job as Donald Hall. He only went to his office once. Hall has never fit in well with convention. Decades ago, he quit his job as a tenured professor and was a huge success as a freelance writer and poet. At 86, he's still writing, but seems to have left poetry behind. His new book is called Essays After 80. Donald Hall, welcome to the program.
Hello. Good to talk with you.
So you write that you say you have stopped writing poetry.
Yes.
When did you stop, and how did it come on in that way?
Oh, I guess it was about 3 years ago, and I realized I didn't have it anymore, and it's just getting old. I think you need higher testosterone levels to write poetry than I have at the moment, but fortunately I can still write prose.
Was it unnerving, you know, to lose that?
No, because it was gradual. I had the sense of poetry fading on me, or me fading on poetry, for several years. And then I would think, no, this is good. And then 6 months later, it wasn't so good. And so I saw it coming. I didn't really see these essays coming, and I'm very glad they came.
How is that different? What is why is it you can do that? Because the prose is awfully poetic. It's pretty beautiful.
I know. Sorry. I think it is too. But
you're allowed to be immodest, I think.
Yes, modesty is my strong suit. But prose is not so dependent on sound. The line of poetry with the breaking of the line, and to me, it's sound is the kind of doorway into poetry. And that my sense of sound, or my ability to control it, lapsed or grew less. I still use it in prose, but the unit is the paragraph. I had 60 years of writing poetry. I should complain, you know.
Well, you write in these essays about that sensuality of poetry. You have this great line that the most erotic poem in English is Paradise Lost.
I like that line. Thank you. Yeah. Yeah.
Explain that for us.
Oh, the Milton's beauty of sound and sensuality. It is all a pleasure of the mouth saying it. Paradise Lost, as we know, it is almost a Puritan poem, but not in the mouth. It's not a Puritan poem.
You've been doing poetry readings for a very long time now.
I know. I wish I had some notion of how many. I don't really.
You have a pretty funny story about how your age has affected how your audiences respond to your readings.
Yes,
they gave you kind of the wrong idea about one poem.
That's right. That's right. I began a reading off with a new poem, which eventually turned out to be no good, but I had hoped it was. And it was thinking about what my grandfather would think now to see me. And when I read the poem, I had just entered on the stage, sort of creeping, you know, and bent over and so on. And after that poem, there was a pause, and then there was a standing ovation, and I couldn't believe it. What a wonderful poem I must have written. But no, they felt as if they had seen, I think I wrote, a cadaver gifted with speech. And they were applauding me, at least partly because they knew they'd never see me again.
You, this book, it's titled Essays After 80.
Right.
You're an old guy now.
Yeah.
People, I think, especially in this country, are terrified of aging. But you write that death has kind of become boring for you.
Yeah, it's strange. I really feel better about aging at the age of 86 than I did at 70. And I cannot drive. I can't walk except by pushing a rollator. But I feel a great deal of energy and excitement, and obviously death is ahead of me. I don't look forward to dying one little bit, but, you know, I simply don't worry about it because it's going to happen to me as it does to anybody.
Is the survival of your poetry, does that give you some immortality?
At some point in this book, I said that I expect my immortality to cease about 7 minutes after my funeral. I have seen so many poets who were famous, who won all sorts of prizes, disappear with their death. I write as good as I can and don't try to turn that into some hope for a future that I could never know. But I've had some people tell me that they knew they were great, and that they would live in literature forever. And my response is to pat them on the back and say, maybe you'll feel better tomorrow.
Donald Hall is one of America's greatest poets. His new prose collection, Essays After 80, is out now. Donald Hall, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you. Good.
A low-budget movie, a first-time director, a cast that's never acted before, and a star who's not yet a star. Maybe that's a recipe for disaster, but instead, that movie made nearly 10 times its budget, and 30 years on, it's a classic.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to get through this thing called life.
Purple Rain. Prince played the Kid, a ridiculously talented young musician on the verge of stardom, a version of himself. Music critic Alan Light tells the story behind the film in his new book, Let's Go Crazy. The pop world was much more segregated in the early 1980s, and before Purple Rain, you could pretty much only hear Prince on black radio. But Light says Prince achieved some crossover success with songs like 1999 and Little Red Corvette.
It was Saturday night. I guess that makes it all right.
Little Red Corvette. not only could they see they were moving to bigger and bigger venues, but also could see more and more white faces in the crowd, you know, week to week as the album was going, and especially as Little Red Corvette was taking off. But still, it's astonishing when you think back. I think that we look at Purple Rain now a little bit and think there was sort of an inevitability about Purple Rain. You know, Prince was the great genius of his day, and there was going to be some vehicle that was going to come along and translate that to the world. But if you look at the moment that it happened, when Prince went to his managers and said, "You have to get me a feature film deal or you're fired." And what came out was a movie with a first-time director, first-time producer, Prince as the star who'd never acted, his band as most of the cast, and they said, "We're going to shoot in Minneapolis in the winter." Now, which piece of that sounds like it was going to be a big success?
Now, when it comes to the film, how much of Purple Rain is really Prince's story? How much is he the kid?
Well, I think that's always, you know, there's always tension around that. It was obviously so much of the fascination at the time when the movie came out. We really didn't know much about Prince. Here was this guy. And it's amazing to look back and think Prince did not do one interview during the entire Purple Rain cycle.
He was on Rolling Stone, the cover of Rolling Stone, a bunch of times without
talking
to them.
Several times without ever talking to them. And though a lot of the details in the movie are not accurate to his life, most prominently, he certainly at the time was playing with this idea that he had one white parent, one black parent. He never addressed that he had two black parents. He is a black man. That's who he is. But this idea that he could sort of keep any doors open for his identity was really interesting to him. I think there's something about Purple Rain that felt real and felt honest to his experience of being an outsider, of not feeling like his music fit in. There was something about that that, you know, whatever the limitations of the acting in the film, was something that resonated with an audience.
You write, and this is actually something that a number of people have said, this is an album that every song on this is terrific. Every song is pretty much a classic. Let's talk about the title song, Purple Rain.
What's really amazing is that recording of Purple Rain that we know, that is 98% the first time that they played that song on stage. Now, if there is anything that shows what kind of discipline and what kind of rehearsal Prince puts his band through, the fact that they went out and the first time they played that song is the version that 30 years later we still know every second of, that's amazing. There's a little bit of editing. There's a verse that they drop. There's some editing in the guitar solo. They added a little bit of echo. But essentially, it is that exact performance. And that is mind-blowing, like to understand that they could just go out there in such perfect fighting shape that they could nail it like that. So what inspired him to write Purple Rain was that when they were touring on the 1999 tour, he was following Bob Seger into a lot of arenas and was very interested in why was Bob Seger such a big star, especially in the Midwest. And Matt Fink, the keyboard player, remembers that he was talking to Prince and said, well, it's these big ballads that Bob Seger writes, and that's what people love. And that Prince went out to try to write that kind of arena rock power ballad that resulted in Purple Rain.
Now, after Purple Rain, or you could say it's actually while Purple Rain was still in the air, Prince decides to move on fast. And it's kind of put to him the way you have it in the book that, Prince, you need to pick. You can't be both Elvis Presley and Miles Davis.
It's such a great line. That's Bob Cavallo, who was one of his managers. He's like, I get it, but you can't be Miles Davis and follow your own whims and directions and also be Elvis Presley and be the biggest pop star in the world. And I think Purple Rain created a struggle for Prince that he's fought with ever since then. Is this guy the biggest cult artist in the world who has a million people who will follow him however experimental he gets? Or is he a guy who fills stadiums and plays the Super Bowl halftime show and is one of the biggest pop music artists in history? What's remarkable going back is he cut off the Purple Rain tour after 6 months very abruptly. He gets to the mountaintop and sees to be a pop star means I've got to keep playing the hits. I've got to give the audience what they want when they want it, and I'm not capable of doing that. So I think right at that moment, he slams the brakes on Purple Rain. He puts out Around the World in a Day and goes in a very different direction. Now, in some ways, that salvages, you know, if he'd gone off and made Purple Rain 2, then you're just on a, you start a long descent that's hard to get out of. Once you've shown I can go and do other things, then you leave all the doors and the possibilities open.
That's Alan Light. His new book about Prince and Purple Rain is called Let's Go Crazy. Alan, it's been really fun talking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Pleasure.
In the world of children's literature, A Bridge to Terabithia stood apart for a long time. When it was published in 1977, not many books for kids took on bullying, complicated emotions, and death in such a direct and sophisticated way. It's an unusual story from an unusual writer. Catherine Patterson was raised by Christian missionaries and was born in China. She considered China her home and lived there until the Japanese invasion during World War II.
I really think of myself as having an idyllic childhood until the age of five, or just about five, and that's when the bombing started and the invasion followed soon thereafter. And those years were very scary years.
Now, you also spent a lot of time in Japan when you were a young woman before you began writing bestsellers. What is it that took you to Japan?
I, of course, really, truly longed to go back to China. And because I've of a missionary background and because I have not just inherited my parents' faith, but I have my own faith. And I had a Japanese friend in seminary, and she suggested that I go to Japan, which was a little bit horrifying for me because my memory of the Japanese was pretty scary.
Right.
And she said, well, if you give the Japanese people a chance, I think you'll get to love them. And what I learned in those 4 years I spent in Japan was how wonderful it is to be loved by people that you had thought you hated. Hmm. And I thought maybe everybody in the world needs to have that experience, to be loved by someone they thought they hated.
Do you feel like there's something of a missionary impulse in your writing? I don't mean so much that there's a religious message, but the desire to spread a message.
Well, you know, I try very hard to stay away from the word message because I think it's poison in fiction. I think you tell your story and then the reader gets to decide what he or she will learn from your story. And if they don't want to learn anything from it, that's their choice.
Well, let's talk about your most celebrated story, your book, and you know we would be talking about this, Bridge to Terabithia. And for those people who don't know the story, I should say there's a major spoiler, so maybe come back in a couple of minutes. The main character in the book is a girl named Leslie Burke. She's a tomboyish, clever kid. Can you talk about the girl who inspired the character?
Well, Lisa Hill, who was my son David's best friend when they were in the second grade, was in many ways like I have pictured Leslie Burke. Lisa was only 8 when she died. Actually, she was struck by lightning. So there were certainly similarities in her. She was bright, and she was funny, and she was athletic, and she was a wonderful kid. And it broke all of our hearts when she died.
And in writing Terabithia, you actually get stuck at that moment in the story, that the chapter where Leslie will die.
Yeah, the only way I could keep her alive was not to write that chapter. As I tell in the book, going to a friend's house, and the friend says, how's your book coming? And I just blurted out that I was writing a story about a friendship between a boy and a girl, and the girl was going to die, but I couldn't let her die. And so I said to Estelle, I think I just can't face Lisa's death again. Well, Estelle knew very well that I had, in that same year, been operated on for cancer. And she said, I don't think it's Leslie's death you can't face. I think it's yours. And I realized she was absolutely right. And if that was true, that I would have to go home and finish the book because I would have to face my own death. It was a great freeing thing for me to face that death and then to move on.
There's this amazing moment, once you get the story out with your editor, which is what makes this into a book, she asks you the question, is this a story about friendship or is this a story about death?
Yes, and I think that's what a great editor does. The great editor asks the right question. And I had thought until that moment that I had written a story about death because it had been a year about death or fear of death. And as soon as she asked me the question, I knew I was wrong. And I said, oh, it's a book about friendship. And she said, well, you need to go back and write it that way. And she said, you know, in a real friendship, both friends change and grow.
You know how much this book is loved by so many people. But, of course, there were people who were, well, attacked Bridge to Terabithia that didn't think that, you know, thought that death in this way was kind of a taboo subject. Did the attacks bother you or get to you at all?
Well, of course, you are always, you love your own book. I certainly love my books. And it's like someone attacks your child initially. But then the more you write, the more you realize that if a book has any power, it also has the power to offend. And there were many people offended by this book. And I'm sorry because I don't like to offend people. But I know that it was a story that I had to tell. And I had to tell it in the way I told it. So I can't apologize for it. I can feel sad that it was hard for them.
And for the people who love the book, you've connected. You write it in the book how you've connected with a lot of the people who've read the book, and they share the deepest and kind of darkest parts of their own experience with you.
Yeah, I thought that was the most amazing thing that happened to me after the book was published because it was such a personal story and such a family story that I wasn't even sure it would ever be published. You know, the most wonderful thing about being a writer is having readers. And they've taken my little story and made something really wonderful with it because they have brought to it their own lives.
Catherine Patterson is the author of so many award-winning books for young people, including Bridge to Terabithia. Her new memoir is Stories of My Life. It was so nice speaking with you, Catherine. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It was lovely speaking with you, too.
For the first time in major college football, there is now a playoff bracket. Alabama, Oregon, Florida State, and Ohio State will compete for the FBS championship. That's the football bowl subdivision. Before this year, there was one championship game. The number one ranked team played number two, and those teams were picked using a peculiar formula with the help of computers, always a controversial process. And before 1992, the national champion was chosen by a poll of insiders. Again, pretty controversial. So now, finally, fans have nothing to complain about.
I think Baylor deserves that four spot. It's better than both TCU.
8 days ago, you told me that TCU is the number three team in the country.
The worst loss by far is Ohio State.
I think it's a combination.
That's what you do.
That's a combination.
All right. So a four-team playoff isn't enough to stave off controversy. So why not expand the playoffs to, say, 8 or 16 teams so all the best teams get a chance to compete for that national championship? Heather Dinich of ESPN has one reason.
With only 12 regular season games and everyone trying to finish the season undefeated, when the margin for error is only 0-1 or really 2 losses, the officials at the college football playoff want to make sure that doesn't change, that every Saturday continues to matter for the postseason implications.
Another argument against expanding is how difficult it would be for students to manage the swelling number of games in a season. Here's Nick Saban, the Alabama head coach, talking to ESPN.
Where do we sort of cross the line here as to academics and playoff systems and fan pleasing and media attention that may have an impact how well they can do in other things that are important?
For the 60 or so teams playing in bowl games this season, they now have 3 or 4 weeks off before that bowl game, the same few weeks when most schools have their end-of-semester finals and term papers due. Any additional playoff games would probably fall on these weekends. So, are the doubters right? Would it be harmful to expand the FBS playoffs beyond four teams? Luckily, college football provides its own answer, the FCS. Big-time college football is the FBS, known as Division 1A. The next level down is the Football Championship Subdivision, a.k.a. Division 1AA. It already has a 24-team playoff.
To their fifth consecutive quarterfinals appearance, North Dakota State, the defending three-time national champions.
North Dakota State has dominated this second tier of college football in recent years. This year, if they go all the way to the championship, they'll have played 16 games. Finals be damned. Esley Thornton is a senior linebacker for the Bison.
It's an adjustment, but, you know, we found ways to work around it, and I don't feel it's affected my grades in any ways. It just forced me to adapt to it.
The way Thornton tells it, he and his teammates just do stuff like tell their coaches when all their finals are and squeeze in homework in any spare moment. We asked him, was there a time when football really got in the way, when the playoffs really made things tough? Here's the best he could come up with.
I had a final last year during our meeting time, and I just let my coach know, and we had to move our practice back to the evening for the whole team.
No big deal for the academic All-American with a 3.92 GPA and three championship rings and counting. The big-time college playoffs are locked in at four teams for the next 12 years, and they won't start for another month. But you know what? North Dakota State and the FCS playoffs are already underway. The Bison play Coastal Carolina this Saturday at the Fargo Dome. This week, we'll see the 50th anniversary of a sacred day for many music fans. On December 9th, 1964, the John Coltrane Quartet recorded the album A Love Supreme. I call it a sacred day for music fans, not just jazz fans, because for people across musical boundaries and cultures, Santana, Bono, Joni Mitchell, Steve Reich, Bootsy Collins, Gil Scott-Heron, hearing A Love Supreme was a revelation. A Love Supreme is Coltrane's ultimate spiritual testament. The Love Supreme is God's love. When I first heard it, I didn't get it. Since I grew up after Coltrane was dead, I listened to the albums all out of order. He was my favorite artist, period. Knowing that A Love Supreme was Coltrane's big statement, I saved it. I loved the wild places Coltrane would take the saxophone. So, that opening to A Love Supreme kind of underwhelmed me. But there's a hypnotic quality that gradually gets into your soul, and before you know what's happened, you're one of the converted. After this serene introduction, the bass introduces this simple theme. Meant to scan with the words, a love supreme, a love supreme, a love supreme. Much as Beethoven grows a great symphony out of the four notes, da-da-da-dum, these four notes, this little blues lick, will take us on an extraordinary journey. Already, even though I couldn't hear it that first time, this music is getting weird. Hear that Latin thing that Elvin Jones is playing on the drums? I won't get into the musicological weeds, but by the time Coltrane starts blowing, there are already multiple rhythms going on simultaneously. It should sound weird and off-kilter, but it swings. It's a little hard to hear the strangeness in 2014, the way it's hard to hear how utterly bizarre and ridiculous Beethoven sounded 200 years ago. And like Beethoven's revolutionary Eroica Symphony, this suite of four movements communicated a profound spiritual and philosophical message. Coltrane refused to commit to a single religion. His idea of God couldn't be contained by any doctrine. But with his saxophone and his band, he could preach. The hippies may have embraced Coltrane, but his path to God and love isn't for the faint-hearted. Coltrane didn't live on Neptune. He was a black man who grew up in the South, had written a devastating ballad for four black girls blown up in their church by a Ku Klux Klan bomb, had conquered a heroin habit that almost destroyed him. People had channeled emotions into music before, but no one had ever played the blues like this. And it's the same message we get from the blues. Even with the struggle and the suffering, we sing, because life is a blessing. As much as Coltrane made his saxophone cry for his suffering and the world's, in A Love Supreme, he's telling us that the most important voice to raise is one of gratitude to the Creator for the gift of life. For those of you not so spiritually inclined, don't get hung up on the word creator. Whether you call it God or the universe, devout atheist Penn Jillette talked about his supreme gratitude for his existence, for winning the huge genetic lottery, as he put it. That's the gratitude Coltrane is expressing. It's universal, and we can all feel it. For the week ending December 7th, 2014, that's the podcast edition of All Things Considered from NPR West, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The production staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Tom Dreisbach, Priska Neely, Daniel Hajek, and Becky Sullivan. Our intern is Chloe Prisinos. The technical director is Patrick Murray, with technical support from Marcia Caldwell and Leo DeLagila. Muthoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Arun Roth. We'll be back next week. Remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.